Our next speaker is Emeritus Professor Bob Douglas, who is a former Dean of Medicine at Adelaide University. He's the founding director of the National Centre for Epidemiology and Population Health at ANU. And since his retirement about a decade ago, he helped form Australia 21 and Sea Change. Join me in welcoming Bob.
Thanks very much, Jenny, and thanks for the invitation. It's an important discussion, and when Jenny asked me where I'd like to go in the list, I didn't want to be at the end because I thought everything would have been said by then, especially by our distinguished theologians. So I have titled my talk, Migration Morals in the Balance, because while from an ethical perspective I think a number of issues are very clear, I find the ethics of being a member of the human race in the context in which John's discussed it quite complex and quite challenging. So how do we decide what is ethical when we talk about migration or indeed anything else? As I understand it, ethics is about deciding what is right and wrong. Now, having recently worked through Jonathan Haidt's book, The Righteous Mind, I'm aware of the complexity of moral and political judgments and the cultural and developmental factors which lead us to ethical and moral conclusions. Haidt says that our minds were designed for groupish righteousness and that we are deeply intuitive creatures whose gut feelings tend to drive out strategic reasoning. And he likens ethics or morality to a rider on an elephant. The elephant is full of our intuitive reasoning that's developed from our conditioning and our genetics, and the rider rather inadequately tries to control what is going on in the elephant. But all of this is very complex, and as a simple soul, I'm going to settle for the golden rule. Treating others as I would like to be treated, as my arbiter of what is right and wrong in considering Australian migration policy in 2014. So the starting point for me to recognise is that migration is only a small part of the deep and complex web of crises that now confront humanity. We're a small but integral part of a rapidly shrinking human world. That world now faces a series of five interconnected crises that include climate change, excess population, ecological footprint or consumption excess, a fractured economic system, and a breakdown of governance. Each of these five critical systems and issues can be and usually are thought about separately, but they're absolutely interconnected. And we cannot fix one without attending ultimately to all of the others. And having recently read and the other day launched Jeff Davies' book, Sack the Economists and Disband Their Departments, I think we have to start with the economy. But that's for another talk. Of course, Australia is one of the most affluent countries in the world. We have a very low population density, with 5% of the world land mass, much of it admittedly uninhabitable, but only 0.3% of the human population. We are generally peaceful and said to be democratic. And we're surrounded by sea borders, beyond which are many countries which themselves are seas of misery. Australia is blessed with outstanding social and physical capital. Our own per capita ecological footprint is about three times the global average and is unsustainable even with our riches. But we live pretty well. So it's not at all surprising that people in less satisfactory circumstances want to come here in their millions. And as these crises increase, why won't there be millions and millions and millions more people wanting to call Australia home? Last December, Joe Wodak and I edited a book of essays for Australia 21 entitled Refugees and Asylum Seekers, Finding a Better Way. Sir William Dean, who launched the book at Parliament House, began his talk by pointing out that he was the great-grandson of a refugee who came by boat. I have copies available here at the back for anybody who'd like to buy this book for $25, and the money will go to help fund the next phase of our asylum seeker project, which I shall discuss briefly in a moment, but I'll leave it to your ethics to decide whether you put $25 in the box or $500 in the box. The 24 essayists who contributed to the volume included two former refugees, a number of lawyers, the former head of the Defence Force at the time of Tampa, the former head of the Australian Federal Police Force at that time, a number of refugee advocates, several former senior public servants who've been involved with immigration and refugee policy, a former senior administrator of UNHCR, David Corlett, the man who produced the SBS program Go Back to Where You Came From, a well-known ethicist, a psychiatrist, and a former head of the Liberal Party, the chair of the Human Rights Commission, and ordinary citizens also contributed to the volume. Now, as editors, we found it to be an enormously rewarding task. We had made it clear to our invitations to authors that we were wide open to new ways of thinking about the asylum seeker issue. And there are some very rich and valuable suggestions in the volume. The 24 authors were in remarkable agreement on 5 points. The first is that current policies are inhumane, uneconomic, and unjustified in terms of international, national, and societal obligations. The second was that core values of fairness and compassion have been sacrificed for political expediency. The third was that demonisation and dehumanisation of asylum seekers as opportunistic queue jumpers has been systematically carried out as part of an unsavoury bipartisan effort to stop the flow of boats. All of the authors felt that we could do and must do much better than we're doing, and many of them emphasised the need for genuine collaboration with source and transit countries of refugees. Now, it was always our intention to use this volume of essays as a starting point to provide the politicians with some specific ways out of the mess into which they've got themselves. By simply concentrating on the effort to stop the boats, our polity has switched off completely from any openness to the real nature of the process that lies behind the waves of refugees. And I think John's already referred to some of those processes. Australia 21 is now working closely with the Centre for Policy Development and the Andrew and Renata Caldor Centre for International Refugee Law at the University of New South Wales on the next stage of our strategy. A discussion paper prepared by Peter Hughes, John Menadue and Aria Keskinumi is setting the scene for a round table of politicians and experts that will be held at Parliament House on July the 11th. Each of these three people have a wealth of experience on refugees. Menadue was head of the Prime Minister's Department at the time of the Indo-Chinese inflow. Peter Hughes negotiated, very frustratedly, the Malaysian agreement. And Aria Keskinumi has played a key role as a senior Immigration Department officer on refugee policy for many decades. Now, our hope is that we can identify some new directions which could be acceptable to all political parties. We're attempting to focus on the pragmatic need for a feasible four-party approach that all Australians could again feel proud of and that could meet our obligations as a rich nation. Developing strategy in this field is fraught, however, with ethical and political hazard. Let me change tack slightly and say something about ecological footprints. The ecological footprint, as I'm sure most of you know, is the area of biologically active land and water that the average person requires to live in the way to which they are accustomed. For the 15% of the world population who live in high-income countries, the average ecological footprint is 6.4 global hectares per person. For the 48% of the world's population who live For the 48% of the world's population who live in medium-income countries, the average ecological footprint is 1.9 hectares per person. And for the 37% of the world's population who live in low-income countries, the average footprint is 0.8 global hectares per person. And Canberra's footprint is 9.2 global hectares per person. Some real ethical issues are here. We in the affluent West are using up much, much more than our fair share of biologically active land and water. The ecological crisis that now confronts us arises from the fact that the world is living at a rate of consumption and a size of ecological footprint that is 50% greater than can be sustained by the planet in the longer term. Now, I've presented in this graph from the Global Footprint website the per capita ecological footprint and the per capita biocapacity of two countries, Australia and Bangladesh, considered over time. In both cases, the data for this comparison ends in 2005, and the situation has got much worse since then. But the out-of-date graph makes the telling ethical point. The dotted line in each case represents the per capita biocapacity of the available land and water needed to serve the living needs of its population. That's biocapacity is the top line in the Australian version at the top, and the ecological footprint is the bottom line. The biocapacity is declining steadily, but there is still some available biocapacity that we haven't used on a per capita basis, if you consider Australia as a per capita, on a per capita basis. When we come to the Bangladesh graph on the bottom, it's on a very different scale, because Bangladesh has nowhere near the ecological footprint that Australia has, but it is already well above its biocapacity per capita. It is in biological deficit. And the Australian per capita ecological footprint is 10 times that of the average Bangladeshi. So, back to the ethics of migration. In terms of my simple golden rule view of ethics, it's wrong in our globalised world to assume that we in Australia have absolute entitlement to all of the territory we currently control and manage. It's wrong for us to put up the barriers and ignore or deny that the rest of the world is crumbling around us. It's wrong to treat refugees and asylum seekers as non-people. It's wrong to deny that we have any responsibility for what is happening in these areas. It's wrong knowingly to continue to plunder the earth and not to dramatically contract our footprint. And it is wrong, as well as insane, not to use what we know and what we can do to ameliorate the problems which underpin the crises that the world is now facing. So, what is right? I think it's right to treat those in straitened circumstances with compassion and understanding. To be willing to share our good fortune as widely as feasible with those who have been more or less fortunate than we. It's right to take coordinated action on the basis of what we know, to address the core problems that underpin the refugee problem, and it would be right to build our migration policy on the basis that it will reinforce core values and contribute to net community and global well-being. So all of that seems pretty clear. But it's much more difficult to decide what is the right thing to do on the following issues. Firstly, how should the world regulate the flow of refugees in ways that do best possible justice to their needs and ours? What is the right thing to do about the five core problems in time to avoid the civilization collapse that John was talking about and to reduce the refugee flow? How can we best deal across borders? Sorry. This is a disaster when you press the wrong part of this iPad. How can we best deal across borders? With those countries that are involved that share aspects of the problem with us but are less well off than we are, and those which are hostile to our values. And finally, how can we build the requisite skills in Australia to maintain a viable economy and community while not impoverishing other countries of their skills? So here, in a nutshell, is my current view on what we should do about these five core issues. I have said earlier that we cannot think about these things as independent entities, and that climate change, refugee flows, mass migration, population growth, footprint excess, and shortages of land and water are all part of a network of problems which are absolutely interconnected by a sick economy. We're facing a critical decade which will determine the viability of the global human population. So we must urgently build a new vision for Australia in 2050. The kind of transformative change we need will only begin with transformative economic change, and I think it's fair to say that tipping points for economic disaster are bearing in upon us. We need to be ready for them. We should restructure our economy around sustainable, inclusive growth, and we should set 10-year population targets that are justified by the evidence of our declining ecological footprint. We know how to mitigate climate change and could be leading the world and building our economy around the effort. And of course, we should be very substantially increasing our foreign aid on population matters. We could accommodate many more people in Australia if we could halve our ecological footprint. And we could do it very rapidly by reducing our carbon emissions drastically. Refugees are expensive migrants, but they are considerably less expensive than our current policy of deterrence is costing us. I would argue that we should increase our humanitarian intake to at least 80,000 per year and scale back on other elements of our migration that John's referred to, while working urgently towards a halving of our ecological footprint. And we should work collaboratively with UNHCR, regional and source countries to identify our migrant intake and make it known that we will fly home to source countries those who arrive in our country and are not genuine refugees. We should phase out all detention centres and grant citizenship support and an apology to those thousands currently in detention. The former leader of the Greens in the ACT, Deborah Foskey, with whom I was involved in developing Sea Change, wrote this on the cover of the Sea Change book: "When the people lead with vision, governments will follow." I think she's absolutely right. It's time for we the people to lead with vision rather than from our hip pockets and greed. Hundreds of thousands of Australian people are restless and concerned about the future. Our economy is now facing enormous difficulties, and neither of our major political parties is leading with vision. The boats may have stopped, but the refugee issue will not go away. Migration is just one of a constellation of approaching crises for which we must build a composite national vision on population, climate change, the economy, inequality, footprints, governance, and the time is critical. The recent marches in March could well be the beginning of marches in April, May and June. In an article I published in the Fairfax Press a couple of months ago, I said, "Our political leaders seem to have turned their backs on the difficult task of delivering a viable future for our descendants. Neither of the major political parties is paying serious attention to a constellation of issues that are crucial to the future for humans. The tough issues such as climate change, environmental sustainability and the way we organise the economy tend to be trivialised in response to the wants and demands of swinging voters and vested interests. We're experiencing a form of political corruption that is driven by focus groups, incessant polling and 24-hour media cycle, as well as a serious monopoly in the media." I concluded that article, as I conclude this talk, by saying that perhaps Australia needs a new non-government structure to coordinate debate on a range of pressing issues in the public interest. The business-as-usual lobbies are well-coordinated, cashed up, and have a highly sophisticated modus operandi, ready to spring into action whenever a whiff of reform is raised. I wondered whether we need a public interest council to do for the public interest what the Business Council of Australia does for its constituents and what the Council for Economic Development does for conventional economic thinking.